Good morning, y'all. My name is Jewel. I'm an alcoholic. Man, I'm so glad this moment done finally came. I want to thank Don and the committee, man. I got goosebumps thinking about how nice y'all been to me and Terry. Elizabeth and Mike. It's just a cool thing. It's just really cool. And I got to hear Masoon and my old buddy Roger. I got to keep my composure thinking about Roger, man. That knocking something else, boy. And another cool thing is I got buddies all up and through Allatoona Roundup. Some of them I knew already. Me and Tom go all the way back to aftercare. Aftercare. Me and Tom, and his hair was black and I had hair when we met. It's something else, man. Both of us got bellies now. All kind of stuff done happen, man. Matthew started out at the Heavy Hitters, and that's my home group, guys, the Heavy Hitters Men's Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet every Saturday at 5. Come on down. We don't even run the women off if they come. We just put them in another room. I want to acknowledge my wife coming with me, and she brings up my one. I had to search real hard for an Al-Anon certified joke and a Sunday Sunner certified joke. Combine them together, you know what I'm saying? And this guy, he told us that these three guys died and they went to heaven. And heaven didn't quite turn out like they thought it was going to be. St. Pete greeted them at the door, welcomed about like y'all welcomed me and Terry Friday, told them they had to run of the place, they got eternity to enjoy their life in heaven, but we just need for you to not do one thing. And they wondered what that was, and they said, you can't step on none of them ducks. And they looked at each other and said, that's a pretty good deal. We figure we can get around stepping on a duck. And they went on a couple of yawns, and then one day when I missed and stepped on a duck, whang. And they wondered what could happen to you in heaven, you know what I'm saying? All of a sudden, this great big old door opened, and this ugly woman came out, and they handcuffed her to him. And said, you're going to be stuck with her for eternity. And now they're kind of paying a little more attention to them ducks, right? And a couple of eons went by, and sure enough, another one missed and stepped on a duck. And they just waited, and sure enough, that big, great, big old door opened, and an even god-awful, uglier woman came out. And they handcuffed her to him. And now this one guy was like, man, this heaven thing getting pretty serious, you know what I'm saying? But he managed not to step on no ducks for a long time. And one day the door opened anyway. When this beautiful, drop-dead, gorgeous woman came out. And they handcuffed her to him. And they walked around heaven for a couple of eons. And he just stopped her one day and said, what did I ever do to get caught up with somebody like you? She said, I stepped on a duck. So me and my wife, we get into them tiffs sometime where, you know, I'm putting on the same shirt twice in the same week, or, you know, I ain't took my socks off before I got in the bed or something like that, and she'll just be fussing and I'll be fussing back, and I get her, I say, remember now, you stepped on a duck. That's good. I ain't gonna be able to keep y'all laughing long as Roger did, but I'm gonna try. They said in this program you're supposed to tell it like it is in short order, and that's what I'm gonna try to do. I'm born and raised in Savannah, Georgia, 1953. I'm 65 years old. And I've been sober for the back half of the entire back half of my life. I almost done forgot my war stories. But I ain't forgot what happened to me after I got here. I want to tell y'all a little bit. My family, my grandmama made some of the best peach brandy this side of the Mississippi River. And my granddaddy, him and his buddies were moonshiners. All my big cousins were moonshiners. And I think my first drink came when I was about 4 years old. My grandmama would hit me with a teaspoon of that peach brandy to knock me out so I can go to bed. And I figured something was wrong even way back then when I would wake back up so I could get another one of them shots. My neighborhood, they did well with moonshine, and they built the first brick bungalow in our little subdivision in Garden City, Georgia. We had the first indoor plumbing and all that good stuff. And my neighborhood didn't get paved or sewage or anything like that until 10 years after I was gone. I graduated in 71. And come up here to Atlanta, Georgia to go to school. And 10 years later, they finally laid pavement in my neighborhood. So I'm literally from dirt. Literally. The big objective when I was growing up was to get back after kindergarten without being dirty. Now you tell me how you not going to get dirty and you playing on dirt. So it was cool. I did have loving parents. They taught me. They made me go to Sunday school. I was telling somebody the other day that me and my granddad and my brother would get haircuts on Sunday morning before we went to church, and we had to go. I also tell a lot of people I am truly a train up a child the way he must go, baby. If y'all Christians know what I'm talking about, I don't have to go any further. But something happened. Something happened. Came on me kind of subtly. Wasn't no great big old turn of events. I do remember when I was 80. Hey, Jerome. How you doing, buddy? No, I just like when my friends come, I like to let them know I see them. My mom and dad broke up when I was a young kid, and that was a traumatized thing because we were roused out of our sleep, and she took me and my brother to my godmother's house, and we was wondering what was going on. It wasn't no big thing. We didn't know what was happening. But a few days later, me and my buddies were coming home from school when I seen my father leaving. And you know, Roger's talking about his dad. You know, to see your dad, I don't care what the circumstances is, I was real proud that I was walking up on my dad, and I asked him, where was he going? And he put me down, and he said he'd be back. That turkey didn't come back. I didn't see him no more until I was about 10 years old, and he bought me a 10-speed English racer, a 3-speed English racer. It was too big for me, so I spent the next about 8 or 9 years chasing other folk trying to get my bicycle back. You'd be surprised where resentments can develop from, you know what I'm saying? Now, I want to tell you all this. I got to lay a few groundwork rules, and one of them is that my sponsor always says, and my sponsor's Bill S. down in Roswell, whenever he introduced me, he would always say, you don't get from where Jewel was to where he is without a divine act of providence. And he started, when he used to say it, it used to irritate me, then it used to humble me, and then it got me curious. What is he talking about? So I looked up the word providence, and then, you know, in a real simplified version of the definition, it's like the hand of God going before me, preparing the way, right? So what he's saying is, you know, if without God, I wouldn't have got here, basically is what he's saying. And another thing I want to tell you about is that this disease is a disease because a disease affects each one of the sufferers the same way. And treatment of that disease affects each one of the sufferers the same way. So if you got this disease and you take the medicine and you have to take all of the medicine, you know what they tell you? You know, some of us get these kind of ailments and maladies where they give you a prescription and they look at you with one eyebrow raised and go, remember now, take all of the medicine, lest you won't get all the way well. You know what I'm saying? And here I would like to early on admonish you before you get sleepy, bored, and start sneaking out to take all of the medicine for this disease, because it might not take if you don't. Now, I had those two little resentments, and we rocked on steady. I left high school, and I went to college. And when I went to college, something happened. Nobody was watching. They was all stuck back there in Savannah, and all hell broke loose. You know, I'm supposed to be a pretty decent guy. You know, I got manners. I hold a door, and I do all those other things, but. You know, when I got to that 190 proof grain alcohol and that Bacardi rum, that 98 proof Bacardi rum, and it was exotic because it said Bacardi. So we got some more stuff these days, but you know, they had Bacardi rum, and rum came out of the Caribbean and people of color were in the Caribbean. So I thought that was kind of, you know, kind of neat, but alcohol never really was like a real big deal to me because I grew up around moonshiners and wine makers. In fact, my father was a wino. I didn't know it. I'll tell you how I found that out in a minute. But because he left, remember he left, you know. And I grew up through my elementary days resentful at my mama and daddy. Now, they weren't big resentments because they didn't, every beating I got, Roger, I deserved it. You know what I'm saying? And so it wasn't about how they beated me or treated me. My daddy had lied to me. At least I thought he had. And my mom, I was mad at her because when we got the PTA, I only had one parent, man. You know how cold-blooded a kid can be? Where your daddy? Where your daddy? You ain't got no daddy. What's wrong with your daddy? Why y'all ain't, you know? It don't seem like much to y'all, but, you know, I got kind of mad at her for not having me no daddy at PTA meeting, man. You know, and that followed me all the way till I got here. I couldn't talk to my mama because I was mad at her. So I just, you know, sent signs, you know, hooky and. You know, all that kind of stuff. I did keep up pretty decent grades. So I want to tell you, I've always been smart, so don't hold that against me. I always had a little bit of sense. I always got my lesson. I always did pretty good in school. And they sent me off up here to Morehouse College, and that's where Martin Luther King and all those other guys went, you know, civil rights guys went. And it's like the black Yale, you know. I mean, really, that's what we think it is anyway, you know. A lot of good guys come out of there, and we had a lot of tradition to follow. You know, I'm supposed to at least, you know, keep my diction straight and don't get stuck up too bad on Ebonics unless it's strategically necessary and stuff like that, you know. And I went on through, I got to college, and my best buddy, he got drafted into Vietnam. I partied out of my first year, and I went back home, and my folks finally got the grades. So, you know, I just dropped out of school at them. It was easier to just drop out than to go back and do what I was supposed to do. And eventually that led to me joining the Navy. And in the Navy, man, in the Navy, they had all sorts of cool things, man. They had brought forward the idea of better living through chemistry. And you could do all kinds of things with all kinds of chemicals in the United States Navy, man. You can get them in different colors. You can do botany and come up with different kinds of plants that give you different kinds of emotional and mental effect. You could take pills that would actually enhance your vision and to the point where you're seeing things that weren't even there. You can go to a bar and you could actually cross cultures and not even know it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, things were happening, man, in the 70s and 80s. And I finally got out of the Navy, and I was so afraid. Something was up. I couldn't tell what it was. I was skating around the side of trouble. You know, I wasn't quite getting in trouble, but it was always there, you know. And I finally got back to the United States, and I got into college, and I got out of college. And I was so afraid to not do what my folk had sent me away from home to do until I took every political science course Morehouse College had in their books. And one day they just had to tap me on the shoulder and tell me it was time to leave. So every now and then, you know, unmanageability can kind of work out for you. You know what I'm saying? And so I finally graduated. But right before I graduated, political science is like pre-law. You know, all those guys were in there. You know, we had a Phi Beta Kappa department. He was just encouraging us to go on, and we were a new wave. You know, I'm like post-integration, pre-affirmative action kind of brother. I mean, they were getting us ready to go out there, and I was supposed to take this test to get in law school, and I partied the night before, and I woke up just with barely enough time to get to the doggone test site, get my number two pencil, get my test paper, fall asleep, slobber all over the test. It was bad. I didn't even know it was bad, though. I came back and lied and said, you know, there was a certain political faction that was conspiring to make sure I didn't pass that test. And I never told them it was me, you know. And that ate at me. That really ate at me until I got here, you know. Providence, right? So it rocked on. Nothing was right. Nothing was right. I got out of college. I got a job. I met my wife right before I got out of college in 1979, and by the grace of God, she's still sitting there. You can probably hear me say, by the grace of God, she's still sitting there for a few more times, because it's true that by the grace of God, she's still sitting there. But anyway, we met. I was a thespian, which means I acted in plays, for those of you who if you want to know, and she liked to come to plays, and she would watch me come to plays, and I had gotten this job where they gave you a expense account, a car, and a desk with your name plate on it, and I was doing the happy hour thing in Metro Atlanta, and one night me and one of my buddies went to this club called Mr. V's Figure Eight, and they let us in, and Terry and one of her girlfriends was in there, and when I asked Terry to dance, she told me no the first time. So I was gonna just take her, you know, take her buddy, you know, it was, you know, come on, baby. And she gave me her phone number on a piece of napkin and yellow marker. I almost lost the thing, and I called her back, and we'll get back to that in a little later because she did some cool things too. Some cool analogies I want to show you. And I just didn't get it right, man. And things were going bad. I left that job, and they sent a severance check. And, you know, it was so bad at my job. If I got there, I couldn't stay. Right? So I'd get there. At about 12 noon, I'd fake like I was going to lunch, and you wouldn't see me no more. By the end of the week, I'd have 5 jackets at work. And I'd be leaving with the jackets all together, acting like I was taking them to the laundry. But all I was doing was just trying to get them out there so I could use them next week. And little real subtle stuff, man. I finally lost that job, and they sent me a severance check, and I gave it to my wife and promptly went to... You know, Tilly and ATMs had just advented, so you could write a check and beat the check to the ATM and get all the money out. And she was writing checks. They were bouncing like the Globetrotters. Their balls are bouncing everywhere, man. And then in desperation, I tried to come up with another conspiracy with a guy who had stolen a courier van, and long story short, we ended up trying to sell that courier van to the DeKalb County Vice Police. show you what a great, efficient criminal I am, right? And I thought that was the worst day of my life. You know, I had contraband in my cigarette pack, and you know, I'm gonna tell you how insane you can get, right? I was in the holding cell on my way into jail, and I had this contraband in my cigarette pack, and I was trying to figure out where could I put this so I could get it on the way out. You know, I mean, you know, I really didn't, but I wanted to make sure I kept up with my stuff, and I was more concerned with the stuff than what Terry and her daddy and all of was going to say when they got me out. So they gave me a call. I called my dad, my stepdad, who's a great guy, by the way, and he asked me, did I do it? I said, no, sir. He said, cool, you'll be all right. Click. Now I got to call Terry, right? So I called Terry, and she answered the phone. I said, hey, baby. I hung the phone up myself, man. So, you know, you're talking about dilemmas, right? You're talking about dilemmas? That was, you know, we get in some bad dilemmas, us drunks and junkies. We get in some bad dilemmas, you know. Need the help, can't take the help, can't want the help, gotta want the help. It's just bad, man. And I thought that was the worst day of my life. You know, my mom and dad did not send me out of the house to end up in the back of no police cruiser going to jail for committing felonies. That's not why they sent me away from home. It was more embarrassing than it was humiliating for the kind of guy that I was raised to be by my folk. You know, they weren't perfect, but they were good people. And here I am just, whew, messing up bad. And I was intellectual about messing up, but I wasn't spiritual. I couldn't feel it. I knew it was bad. You know, I got some analogies for that too, but it turned out that, you know, let me tell you what had happened earlier, in December of 1985. My wife, you know, she had an uncle that was pretty big time executive for Gulf Oil, and he threw these wonderful, wonderful New Year's Eve parties. I'd gone to a couple before, and, I had convinced Terry to allow me to go get us two bottles of champagne to take to that party. And I left there about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And when the smoke cleared, Auld Lang Syne was playing. And I was on my way back to the house with one of the bottles of champagne and actually feeling victorious that I still had that one, right? And Auld Lang Syne was playing. And I decided to make a New Year's resolution. And something said, you ain't gonna keep no damn resolution. And it was right. So I threw a hand grenade. I said, God, please get me off drugs and alcohol in 1986. And I went on to the party, and I walked in the door, and there was Terry with her aunts and sisters all sitting around looking like a congressional investigative committee. And she was looking at me like I just farted, you know. You know how you look at people when they do something wrong and you can't say nothing to them, right? She couldn't really say what she wanted to say, but she gave me that look, and I knew what the look meant. But I couldn't feel it. I'm going somewhere with that, right? And so that night went by. But 9 days after I said that prayer, I was in the back of the police cruiser. Right? I said the prayer. I done screwed up at the house. I said the prayer. I was in the back of the police cruiser. And 20 days after I said that prayer, I was in a halfway house. Right? And... About maybe 10, 12 days into that, I got a sponsor. Now, I said this prayer on New Year's Eve, right? Now, my sponsor said, you don't get from where I was to where I am without a divine act of providence. And providence is the hand of God going before you, preparing the way. Everything ain't going to be comfortable, right? Now, it took me years to get this. Don't get me wrong. I'm not no doggone big table of wisdom that's just popped up and epiphanized this 2 seconds ago and came in here to tell y'all this, right? No, man, I had to study this because I wanted to see if it was correct. I'm a skillful skeptic. You know, if I'm going to lie my way out of something, I got to know exactly which paragraphs to implore when. You know what I'm saying? And this stuff ain't letting me out. It ain't letting me out. It's dragging me in deeper. Right? So I got this into this halfway house, and I got this sponsor, and then we get to these 12 suggestions. Right? And the first one, I saw the first one when I was in detox. I saw it. I agreed with it. I accepted it because it was in the room when you had group, the TV with the VCR attachment to it was backed up to it, and the only thing you could see was the first step. Intellectually, you know, I got a degree. I can understand a paragraph. And I understood it, and I said, wow, that's pretty appropriate. Powerless over my, I said, you know, they might be trying to get me some kind of way, because that sounds too true. But I got it, and I got out of detox, and I got in a halfway house, and I got 30 days, and they gave me a scholarship to a men's retreat, and I went to this men's retreat, and once I got past all of my, you know, my idiosyncrasies, cultural and otherwise, I started getting somewhere. How about that? I sat in a few workshops, and I started seeing and hearing some things from unlikely sources. See, it's kind of hard to hear somebody you think trying to manipulate you. You know, we all, even daddy's trying to just get me, she's trying, my wife's just trying to get me to take this thing off so I look better, even though I don't, you know. But from unknown sources, some guy across the room that don't even look like you, but sound like you, same symptoms, he being treated. You know how you do when you got a cold, you ask somebody what you do, they tell you to go get some medicine, and if you take the medicine, you'll start feeling just like they felt. You would. So I started hearing these things, and powerlessness. You know, we get in these rooms, we get powerless over everything, but this a newcomer in here needs to know powerlessness really means that if I drink, I have no ability to not want to drink again. You know, if you got pet animals, you know, if an animal sees you eating and he comes to you with all his great telepathy and try to convince you to give you some of his food and you don't, he'll forget he wants it and go away. That's what abstinence is. Just to let the disease forget it's trying to get you and go away, man. That's powerlessness. But if you don't, you ain't got no power to not want to do it again. It's almost like poison ivy, right? If you get poison ivy on you, you have no power to avoid the rash. It's coming. The only way to avoid the rash is to don't get in the poison ivy. Abstinence. Then there's unmanageability. Unmanageability started all the way back when I was playing hooky from Sunday school. Because you're supposed to be someplace. The rules say be here. I'm here. And any of the consequences like getting caught, not being able to play football, getting the marbles taken away, this, that, and the other, that's as the consequences of me not not being where I'm supposed to be and doing what I'm supposed to be doing at that time. You know, like when, you know, the night before the test, I should have been getting a good night's sleep, you know, all of this good stuff, so I can make it to the test, be fine, da-da-da-da-da. Unmanageability. Contraindications of alcoholism is unmanageability. You know, I'm up here, I'm a lawyer, but this stuff is they call it illness. What you do with illness, you take it to a doctor. You take it where it gets treated. What you think we doing in here? This ain't no mutual admiration society. This treatment. This treatment, y'all. We just lucky. You know, it's another one of them paradoxes. Instead of getting stuck and prodded on and, you know, all kind of things put in all kind of weird, delicate places, we just get to come sit in a room and get treated. Pretty cool. For I mean, we deserve it, though, because we done been through some crap, man. Some kind of way, emotionally, physically, we've been through some crap. So we deserve this kind of treatment. High quality, luxury, free food, ice cream, cake, hugs. You know, tolerable people that tell you what to do. Sponsors, you know what I'm saying? We get to do pretty good, man. But that's step one. That was one thing. Now, step two is a formula for success. Step two is belief plus power equals restoration. Formula for success. Therein lies hope. Belief plus power equals restoration. It's something to aspire to. You know, I mean, you know, like when you, the ladies understand this, they'll see the sale, 20% off, 8 days. They know if they go in 8 days, they're getting 20% off. But all until they go, it's an aspiration. It's hope. There's going to be something good when I accomplish this activity. They go through spirit, you know, particular, I won't go so far as to call it spiritual. But they go through particular kinds of processes to end up pulling out that coupon and receiving that discount. Hope. So with the step two, that's just an aspiration. That's just something to keep you moving. Then we get to the next step. The next step is the contract. The third step prayer is contract, guys. If you save me from me, God, I'll tell everybody you did it. That's it in a nutshell. You know, they pay me to break stuff down, right? That's it in a nutshell. God, if you save me from me, I'll tell everybody you did it. That's kind of like why I'm up here today. I'm trying to keep my part of the bargain. You know, that even ain't all of it. And just in case you newcomers don't realize it, ain't but one step on using. I heard somebody at the meeting down at the cookout yesterday. She said something about, well, I'll get back to it. I don't want to waste all my time. But she said something real neat, and it's going to come to me. She did. It's about the God thing. We were talking about God yesterday, and she said something real neat, and I said I was going to repeat it today. Usually when you try to, you know, ad lib, it goes like this right here. But anyway, we got to the third step prayer. We made that deal, and this thing is ongoing, guys, because everything I'm doing, I know I told y'all that they only got one step on using. The other step, the other 11 is on behavior modification. And not just physical and mental behavior modification, but it's also spiritual behavior modification. My spirit has been neglected. It's been put aside. It's been ignored because the spirit actually taps you on the shoulder. That thing that told me I wasn't gonna keep no resolution before I knew any of this. That's my spirit telling me, you're wasting your time, bro. It ain't going to happen like that. You know what I'm saying? So the spirit, and it don't get listened to much. It only starts getting listened. That was, once I prayed, I guess God said, all right, spirit, tell him something. Ease him on this way. You know, and then it probably told my spirit, you know, Jule is such a bad case, we're going to need some intensive care for him. We're going to send him to AA. That's what he did. I think that's what happened to me. You know, Providence. Because my life was in a shambles, and it was in a subtle shambles. You know, I could have kept up appearances and kept a suit on and put on a few rings and got a new car and, you know, made it through the week. But in here, I'd have been done. So now they're getting in here. They want you to do this inventory, you know. And everybody gets kind of crazy about inventories, but I got to this point so quick in recovery, I didn't even have a chance to get scared of it. Them guys, my sponsor, they'll be like, he's, you know, like when you go to the emergency room, they don't ask you no questions until after they finish saving your life. You know, is it all right to do a trach now? After you breathe in so you can talk, man, you know what I'm saying? So they got me in here. They didn't give me a chance because they knew this guy right here with this brain, if they activated it, I would have talked my way out of this. Matter of fact, one of the guys told me in detox, he said, you're a pretty smart guy. I said, yeah, I was going like Gomer, you know. He said, you know, you're about smart enough to miss all of this. I said, do what? It got my attention, man. Because I figured, you know, I'm one of these ones who figured we could figure. You know what I'm saying? I figured I could figure. You know what I'm saying? I wanted the book. They gave me an abuse. I wanted a book. I'm like, what you giving me this for? Take one and try to drink. You'll see. You know what I'm saying? I don't even know if they give you an abuse now. They might be hypnotizing people. Now I don't know what they're doing. But I got to this point where I had to do this inventory, right? And it's a funny thing about resentments. Resentments are things which I have a theory about what you did to me. I think you did me this way. You didn't come back. You let me have no dad at PTA. Truth of the matter is, I'm too young to understand what them two people was going through. If they wanted me to know, they probably would have tried to explain, but they figured this turkey too young to get it. But I'm over there getting something. I'm getting this theory about what y'all did to me. And then I had to tell my sponsor what that did to me. Insecurity. You know, you talking about people pleasing, man. I was so fatally loyal, man, until I ended up with folk that would sell a stolen van to the police. You come up with ways to move chemicals from one place to another. Or we wouldn't even see the moral depravity in bootleg liquor. You know, I just didn't see it. You know. So I had all these theories about, you know, what this meant, you know, and, you know, I kind of got them right-sized. I kind of figured out, you know, after about two or three, the patterns keep repeating themselves. If you're working on this, you know, the same pattern keeps coming up. So after a while, you know, and the same patterns, just like, it's almost like DNA, you know, fear, resentment, insecurity. They just flip around into different kinds of configurations, but they're the same thing. For each person, they're the same thing. They just come out different. Mine might have fear on top and loathing on the bottom or in the middle or somewhere. But you, if you do it, you know how I found this out, Roger? By going through somebody else's with them. You know, I seen it and I said, man, they got the same stuff. But his came first, second, third, fourth. Mine was 5-2. You know, it's just like DNA. It's the same stuff. It just flipped around different. And we all got it. Just like DNA, we all got it. So, you know, if you work on what I got, you might be able to work on what you got. You never know. So then I had to tell somebody which way my DNA was configured, my sponsor. And he was cool. Gerald, my first sponsor, took me through the steps. He was cool. He didn't grunt or moan or anything like that. He just did like this. That's all he did, man. I was glad he didn't say nothing because I was scared I might not want to hear what he had to say. And when I finished, he just hugged me and left. I didn't peep because I don't want to peep out there seeing him puke or nothing like that. But he just left. He told me what to read. He told me to read 6 and 7 And I did what he said, and I said the next prayer. And the next prayer was, God, do with me as thou wilt, make me fit, take away stuff that ain't no good to you and my people, and just take me, man, just take me. And it's a funny thing about that prayer, man, don't pray that prayer unless you are entirely ready. That's the only caveat they got. You must be in, because you will get a ride. You hear me? You will get a ride. You be going, well, wait a minute, I didn't see that. Wow. You start getting, you start seeing stuff you didn't see, you hadn't seen, man. People start bringing messages from places you didn't expect. Good and bad. I started seeing and understanding stuff I wasn't even trying to see and understand. Just because I said that? Because he got it now. It ain't on me no more. He let me do some stuff like go to meetings, help sponsees, be kind to your wife. Little stuff. But the big stuff, he doing it. He doing it. And I'm glad he doing it. I compared it to going to the dentist. You ain't going to pull your own teeth. Bad as it's hurting. You just ain't going to, you might want to, but you ain't going to pull your own teeth. I don't care. I got a few dental issues too, buddy. And I'm not, some of them toothaches make you want to do something, shoot yourself in the head, but you will not pull it. Takes a higher power to pull a tooth. I have to cooperate now. I have to sit there and be still. Keep my eyes on it, because I don't close my eyes at no dentist. I want to be, if you hurt me, I'm going to know, I want you to see, I'm like that with my God. I'm like, I'm looking, God, because you done showed me some stuff. I don't know what you're going to do next, man. I'm going to tell you another little analogy about these character defects. Me and Terry, we had our first date, right? And I done inherited all these risque ties from my granddaddy. These ties are vintage 30s and 40s. I'm walking around in downtown Buckhead with my granddaddy ties on, thinking I'm GQ. My wife works in fashion retail. And we got to Mr. V's figure eight. And she said, honey, why don't you take off that tie and make yourself more comfortable? I said, okay. Wow, I had expectations, man. I had heightened expectations. Just the vernacular in her voice, right? I'm like, okay, we done finally going to get a payoff on this one. All I got to do is take off my tie. Well, I didn't get what I expected. I got better. I got a wife. Way more than I expected. Way more. That defect of my character was slowly pulled off me. I didn't even notice it was gone. I gave it away. Yeah! Because I had certain expectations. Now, they may not have been the proper, correct kind of expectations. And I did not get what I expected. I got more. How about that? I got more. And the same thing with these defects of characters, man. I have some of these things I think I'm clinging to. I don't want to get rid of my insecurity, da-da-da, this, that, and the other. And when you finally convince me to do it, usually your sponsor gives you some kind of irresistible incentive. They stick something out there to make you got to do it because you don't want to get kicked out of the brotherhood or some old crap, And you expect something to come back, and it don't be that. It'd be something better. How about that? Now, this word love up here, we use it so much until it really, it loses its luster because it's just a cliche almost. And especially in an environment like ours where love actually abounds and you don't have to go looking for it. But love is pretty potent. You look around the room, this is love, right? you know. And my higher power, my God, loves me enough to just go before me preparing the way. He ain't going to just take me, you know, and pull me through it. Because he give me, you know, he give me the kind of life he's given me. He want me to live and enjoy my life. That's one of the things he gave to me. He gave me life. And he wants me to live and enjoy it. Bob, you remember Noel Burton Shaw, he used to talk about us, and he said one Sunday morning that what God is going to do is you're going to get to the end of your life, and you're going to go up to St. Peter, he's going to send you to God, and God's going to say, did you like it? Did you enjoy it? Tell me what you did with it. And depending on what you tell him, might be the way you either get in or get out of heaven. I don't know. I'm just tripping. I don't know. I ain't got no collar or nothing, so don't be trying to follow me for no communion. I'm just checking it out. Cause, you know, I heard stuff like, I got epiphanized in here. Y'all be listening for good stuff in here, cause it comes. If I'm open-minded, it'll come to me. I just gotta listen. I just gotta be ready to take it in, right? So I get to, and then I get to nine, and I said, you know, the resentment list is about the theory, but the amends list is about people I know I'm certain I did something to. There's no question that I did this to you. And that has to be made right. And then they tell you to check, keep checking, you know. Keep checking, because you really got to see yourself coming so you can duck. That's what the 10th step is. Because ain't nobody really going to do nothing bad to me but me. I done figured that out now, you know what I'm saying? You know, sometimes in court I use it against some of my adversaries. I get them mad at me so they can do something to themselves. You know, you get a doggone prosecutor mad, they turn red. And the judge won't understand a word they're saying. And you stand there just as calm and serene, you know, thinking about your sponsor and you love your wife. You say, Your Honor, see what I'm trying to tell you? They shouldn't have did this to me, but I'm going to have fun with it as long as they let me. So we get there, and this is the part for today and that I wanted to get to, except for step 12, is awareness of God. That's the principle behind step 11, sought. And the meeting was about seeking yesterday, and I had to sit on my hands and bite my lip because I wanted to tell the whole meeting what I'm going to say today right then, and it would sought through prayer and meditation to improve. Now, improve is not a hard word for somebody like me, because it don't mean I got to get it all the way fixed. It just means I got to creep towards getting it better. You know, I just got to creep towards getting it better. I don't have to get it completely done. I don't have to have this absolute altruistic idea about my relationship with a God and my understanding, because like many people in the meeting said yesterday, I don't know enough. I simply don't. Now, that's not a bad thing, because the step implies that I probably can know enough. It's just about when. How long is it going to take? Well, you know, you got, you know, the actuarial lifespan of a human being, and I was just kind of stretching because we ain't burning the candle at both ends no more, so we got some time. We got some time. You know, we can kind of chip away at this. We can seek and improve. You know, that's what you do, you know, when you're looking for something lost. You know, my wife hides stuff from me, making me think I lost it all the time, so I'm seeking it. I know it's there. I know it's there. At least it was yesterday. You know what I'm saying? Or the other one is, it's right where I put it. Well, that ain't where I put it. But the bottom line is, I'm seeking, man. You know, seeking ain't a hard principle to grab a hold to. You know, the most dangerous thing one of us could do is not do nothing. Just sit and grovel and complain and don't do nothing. Most of the most suffering people I see in this fellowship are the people who are complaining and not doing anything. You know what I'm saying? Now we might struggle, and it's the difference between sitting in a room watching a courageous recovering alcoholic struggle to get through, the courage, the support from his peers, the support from his sponsor. I'm really trying to get this. There is progress in that. And see, that progress is going to be needed for this next step. We're going to get there in a minute, you know. But this seeking through prayer and meditation, you know, if you sit in a room, one of the cool things I got yesterday from sitting in that room was I heard a lot of cool things about seeking. Things that wasn't, you know, I'm not making notes to bring them here to the meeting, but things that I'm trying to interject into my soul and put to work so I can make it to the next day. Because I'm prone to do something. I remember one morning I was walking to work across this causeway, and you know, just in the I'm in the rat race, the commuters going and coming, and I was going across the causeway, and these two people were behind me just laughing and giggling. I took it personal. I thought they were laughing and giggling at me. I wanted to turn around and do something to them, man. I did. And then something came to me and said, "Pray, Jew. You cool, you good, just pray." And I got to the elevator, they still right behind me. And when they got in the elevator and I was facing them, he goes, "Good morning, man, how you doing?" It was gone just that quick. But I was in one of these insane rages, man, in less than 10 meters. And then less than 10 meters later I was all right. So, you know, yeah, you can count these numbers in these years and look at us like we all pass and everything. But they say this thing is subtle, incurable, and fatal. I mean, you might go off in your mind one day. Like I did a preliminary hearing on this guy. He got angry in traffic. And the old man was, they were senior citizen. He was giving this old lady a ride to the doctor, and he missed the light, and the guy behind him, who had failed to take his anger management courses, got out of the car, walked up to the window, fussing at the old man, scared the old man. He took his gun and shot him in the face, and went on, took his son to the doctor, took his child to his friend to the doctor. It's bad, but the guy should have went to anger management. He didn't take his medicine. I mean, you know, stuff like that can happen to people like us. We got some atrocious things that happen to us. So that story ain't like, you know, I can tell this story to some folk like at church, and they've been, "Oh, Lord, please, Jesus." But y'all just sitting here trying to get it. Because stuff like that could happen to us. We see it all the time. We know what insane and unmanageability looks like when we see it. Because we know how it looks. Because we're capable of it without a God of our understanding and some good friends who love us unconditionally, love us. Now, the book says that immunity comes from helping another, immunity from drinking. Immunity. You know what immunity is? Immunity is a pass. Immunity is no responsibility. Immunity is impunity. I know these words are getting kind of far out there, but it means they can't do nothing to you. You will not be able to drink if you're helping somebody. Immunity. Immunity. Now, if you are a newcomer and you scared you gonna drink, just do like Bill them did. Go get a drunk and help him get to a meeting. You won't drink. You just won't. Or if you're an old timer that's been sitting around and you start to feel irritable, restless, and discontent, you wonder what's going on, go get a drunk and take him to a meeting. You will feel better. You just will. It's something about helping people that just make you feel better. It just give you little goosebumps and all kind of stuff, man. You know? It just takes all that other stuff right out, man. Immunity. So we can talk about the service work and the this, that, and the other and all that stuff that embellishes and make people like Don and Mike look good, but they ain't doing it for that. They're doing it for immunity. Immunity. That's why you help people. Why these committee members running around frantically trying to make sure everything's right. This, that. Immunity, man. I ain't gonna get into some of the other analogies I could use for immunity, because it's not relevant to what we're talking about this morning. We're talking about surviving this disease. That's what we're talking about. So, and helping each other survive. It's kind of like self. Consumed. It kind of just like a clock. You know, you start at 1, you go back to 12, you start back at 1, but it's keeping time. You know, that's what we're doing. You know, we just start at 12, go through, help somebody go through, and we just keep getting weller and weller. That's what happens. I can't figure out no other word. I got good training on finding the right words, but that was the one that works. So you just get weller and weller, weller and weller. Because you can get worser and worser too, you know. You know, you can go downhill real fast if you quit taking care of yourself with this disease. I done seen it happen, man. You know, we get to the point where we got it made and we good and we don't come back no more and we hide out in various places and we think that's adequate for our security, and the next thing you know, people in the meeting are going like this about you, shaking their head. Scaring newcomers. Oh, God, he had how many years? You know what I'm saying? That's all, you know. Petrifying these young babies like that. You know what I'm saying? Keep your immunity intact. Help somebody. That's what I do. I ain't scared to do this. Because I'm going to get paid. Not in money. Not a notoriety. I just get to go another day. And they are good. You know, every day is new. New. A new day. New. Look up the word new. Unused. Unblemished. You know. Everybody likes something new. We get a new one every day. We get a new day every day. We got a brand new day, untouched, unseen. The sun ain't never rose on this one before. Brand new. All kind of brand new, unlimited possibilities. New. And then, you know, we get new. We get new. You know, I know you done been back to one of them high school reunions and they don't recognize you because you done got old. They recognize you because your spirit done changed. It's new now. It's new. It's another one. It's another one. They look at you. They recognize your face. They go, yeah, man, you're looking good, man. But they're looking at you because they're trying to figure out why you look the way you look. Just like, you know, I seen my prom date, man, from years ago. I wanted to run. She did not look new. I'm sorry. Please don't send her this tape. But we get to be new. We get to do this all over again. Not all over again tomorrow, but all over again the next moment. We are new every moment. We are new. That's what life. That's why you know how much God loves. We get new every tick. It's another one. We don't get stuck in nothing. Unless you're one of us and you're stuck in the same day, Groundhog Day, stuck in the same day 20 years ago. It's the same old, same old, same old, same. We don't get that. We get new. You know, our relationships are brand new each moment. Each moment I can correct something that I misdid the next moment before. Each moment I get a chance to do something better. I get a chance. You know, so I don't know, man. I want to smoke a cigar and I don't want them to put me out of the hotel before I do it. So we're gonna skip the question and answer service, and I'm gonna tell y'all that my name is Jewel. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you.